Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 153, Medicine Dance, A Shamanic Journey, May 16, 2008. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
Really, it all comes down to choosing between love and fear. Are we going to live our lives acting from love, or are we going to live our lives acting from fear? And what are we really afraid of? We're afraid of dying. We're afraid of not being loved. And so that's another reason the sweat lodge is so powerful, putting us up against understanding and recognizing our fear.
That was the voice of my guest, Marcia Scarborough. Marcia Scarborough is the author of the prize-winning book, Medicine Dance, One Woman's Healing Journey into the World of Native American Sweat Lodges, Drumming Meditations, and Dance Fasts. She's also a freelance journalist with over 75 articles published in a wide variety of national magazines. Beyond this, she's a graduate of the Directors Guild of America's prestigious Assistant Directors Training Program, and she spent 17 years scheduling, planning, and running the sets of major feature films, prime television series, movies of the week, and network sitcoms. She also wrote, produced, and directed an award-winning children's video, The Magic of Martial Arts, which was honored with the Gold Award from the National Association of Parenting Publications. Along the way, Marcia traveled with Buddhist teacher Joan Halifax, danced with movement guru Gabrielle Roth, earned a brown belt in karate from martial arts legend Tak Kubota, practiced in healing ceremonies with Native American mystic beautiful painted arrow Joseph Rael, and produced workshops from Nigerian master drummer, ceremonial leader Ayo Adeyemi. Now, here's the interview. Marcia Scarborough, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Dr. Dave. What a pleasure to be here.
Well, what a pleasure to have you. I want to tell you how much I enjoyed reading your book, Medicine Dance. You know, I interview so many authors that I don't always have time to read the entire book. I confess somewhat abashedly. However, yours was one that I really felt compelled to read every word. It just kind of drew me right along.
Oh, well, thank you. I do think of myself more as a writer than healer or any fancy title like that. My training is journalism, so really I'm just telling my story.
Well, it really comes through. You know, in a way it reminded me of Jack Kerouac's On the Road, in as much as it is sort of a road story. You know, it's a woman's road story. Has anybody ever said that about it before?
No, but I like that. I was going to use the line, it's like eat, pray, love, but without food or water.
Well, that's a good one. It would be even better if I had read that.
It's sort of a woman's journey, but, you know, she goes to Italy and Bali and all these places, and just go out in the desert and starve.
I like, one of the things that I really like about the book is that you don't pull any punches. You're quite open about every aspect of the journey, from your friend's flaws to your own personal flaws, from pot smoking to sexual liaisons. It all feels very real.
Well, thank you. And, you know, I try to keep it really real, and I'm really aware that I'm not at all perfect, and the journey is exploring that and coming to terms with it.
Yeah, and you were so open about that, and how nice that you're in touch with with at least some of your flaws. Often we're not that in touch with them. So that was a really beautiful aspect of it, I thought. Now, your book describes a period of your life where you were drawn into a kind of shamanic journey. Somehow I got the impression that you were at least initially somewhat skeptical about that sort of thing.
Well, I was. You know, I think of myself as being really ordinary, although open to other ideas. And, you know, the journey was motivated by a health crisis where I had a bad mammogram and a lot of other things were going wrong in my life at that time. My marriage was falling apart. My parents had died. My career was definitely going downhill. And then I had a bad mammogram, and it was kind of like, you know, you really need to get it together. You really need to figure out what you can do to make your life better. And right at that moment, someone said there's a Native American medicine man in town doing private healings. And I was desperate enough. I think, you know, the openness came out of desperation to say, okay, I'll try it. I'll try it at this point.
Yeah, I was reminded of Joseph Campbell, who talks about the hero's journey. And what you described, you know, struck me as a kind of hero's journey. And he talks about the first stage of the journey as the call. And I was going to ask you to tell us about the call, but maybe that's what you just did, really, that initially it was your own cancer or this bad mammogram and the fact that your marriage was falling apart. You know, another thing that Campbell talks about when he discusses the call is that generally the hero or the heroine, they're having kind of an ordinary life, everyday life, and then something intrudes to kind of wake them up. And often it's not a welcome thing that comes along to wake them up. So you were having your own version of the ordinary, everyday life in Hollywood as it happens, and then something happens to break that frame. Before we get into the journey, tell us a little bit about that backdrop of your ordinary life at that time.
Well, I had a career that I was enjoying on a certain level in Hollywood. I was an assistant director, which is a person who solves logistical and administrative problems for the director, so it's very much a behind-the-scenes kind of thing. It's demanding and fascinating work, working with a lot of big personalities, big egos, and long, long hours, very physically demanding. And in that, and then you have time off, then you're unemployed for stretches in between, and I would always go travel, like in Asia or something, and use up the money I had saved until I got the next job. I liked that aspect of it, but the long, long hours were so physically demanding, and I was aging, and I, you know, had done it for a long time, and then a lot of work was going to Canada, so there were fewer jobs and younger people who wanted them more than I did. But I think perhaps the thing that really kicked it off was the death of my mother. And, you know, we all experience the death of our parents. My mother was very clear that she did not want to die in a hospital or in a nursing home. And so she insisted that I kidnap her out of convalescent hospital and take her to her home. And so then I was very involved in hospice and her dying process. And I think that was really the opening because I was present for her death and I saw her body after she had died. And I realized then there was something more. There was something that was a body was not hers. Something inhabited the body that was now gone. And that was a spiritual experience on a very visceral level, and it wasn't what I was expecting. It wasn't scary. It wasn't horrible. It was really powerful and majestic. And I think that sparked something that perhaps made me more open when Joseph Rael showed up in my life.
That's interesting, yes, that death can be one of those openings that it can sensitize us to another dimension of being and existence. So,
and in, you know, Native American shamanism, they talk about the great mystery, and there was something, you know, mysterious. There is something mysterious about that. We don't really know what that is.
Well, I like that they talk about it as the great mystery. I'm so distrustful of people who say they know what it's all about. Who have all the answers and can describe in detail everything that happens in the hereafter. I personally subscribe to the mystery idea, so that certainly rings true to me.
And, you know, one of the places on the medicine wheel, and on the medicine wheel I use, it's in the West, is the place of not knowing as being a very powerful place to be able to sit in the place of not knowing. And
oh,
I think in Jungian psychology, you talk about tension of opposites, right?
Yes.
Being able to hold the place between right and wrong, black and white, that Rumi talks about, the field where, you know, I will meet you there.
Well, that's really neat. I'm glad to hear that's a place on the medicine wheel, because it sounds like a place where I spend a lot of time.
Well, and I think we all do, and I think it's when we make friends with that place that we increase our power.
So you mentioned Joseph Real, which I guess is his real name, but he's also, or perhaps the more real name is his Indian name, Beautiful Painted Arrow. So tell us about that initial meeting with him and your first impressions.
The first meeting was when I went for this private healing after I had had the mammogram, and I was in a period of waiting, because once you have the bad mammogram, then they say you have to come back for another one. Oh, but can't get an appointment for 2 weeks, and then
right.
You go for that, and then they say, you know, well, we can't really tell, we're going to have a specialist look at it, but can't get an appointment for 2 weeks. And then the specialist looks at it and is like, well, I really need an ultrasound, but I can't give you an appointment for 2 weeks. So by then, you're so anxious, you feel so powerless. And that was when I had scheduled this appointment with Joseph Real. And, you know, it was something I could do. So I met Joseph, and he did what I now recognize as energy healing. At that time, I didn't really know what it was, but it was scanning the energy body and looking for where the problem was. And as he was doing that, I said I saw something lodged in my breast. And he did an extraction, which is another traditional method. And then when I went back for the ultrasound after all that, I said I felt like the thing that was lodged there had been placed there by my mother. It had something to do with my mother. Okay, breasts, mother, all that stuff. And he suggested a healing with my mother, who by that time was dead, where I could contact her in the spirit world and invite her to be able to support and assist me in this life. And so I, you know, feeling somewhat ridiculous, did that, and then went back for the ultrasound, and the result was they couldn't find anything at all. And by then, you know, I was hooked and really interested, and synchronistic series of circumstances kept drawing me deeper and deeper into the work, the shamanic work.
The synchronistic series of circumstances, I really resonate to that phrase. To me, it's always very exciting. It makes me feel like I'm in some kind of special flow when those synchronicities start happening. So that was
you are in the special flow.
Yeah. And so there was that period there when these synchronicities started to cascade all around you and kind of draw you in.
And that was a very scary and exciting time. And part of it involved my very close woman friend from college being diagnosed with very serious cancer right after I had been cleared of the cancer. And both of our mothers had died of cancer. And we had made an agreement that since we were both divorced, didn't have children, that, you know, we would be there for each other if anything ever happened. And so she did have the serious diagnosis. Interestingly, at that time, she was living about 15 minutes away from Joseph's home. And so I went to be with her, and then that created the opportunity for me to really consult with Joseph on a regular basis as I was helping her. And so, you know, that was really an opportunity that I think a lot of people didn't have, because I had a lot of one-on-one consultation with Joseph, and I became very comfortable asking him questions about how this all worked.
Yes, and, you know, one of the things that I had an interesting reaction about some of that, and this is more about me than about you. You had a number of consultations with him over a period in the book, and I noticed that he would charge you for these, and my initial reaction was funny, probably rooted in some of my own personal puritanical notions that spiritual guidance should be free, and I tend to be trustful of these gurus and evangelical preachers that rake in lots of money. On the other hand, we expect to pay for therapy, and he was providing you with a kind of therapeutic consultation, and I guess he wasn't getting rich in the process either.
Well, and didn't Jung say that therapy doesn't work unless you pay for it yourself?
I don't know if he said it in quite those words, but I know that that notion...
That in our culture, we don't value it unless we pay for it.
Yes, there is that notion out there.
And if we were living in a tribal situation with Joseph or any medicine person in the village, I think the village would be supporting him as far as, bringing him the food and things that he needed to survive so that he could be available to them.
Sure, that makes sense to me. And it was just this little initial jolt, and then I had to go through kind of a reasoning process like you just did to kind of say, yeah, well, it's reasonable that he needs to support himself, and he has these skills and talents that I'm sure he worked hard to develop.
And, you know, that is somewhat controversial. I think a lot of people have that kind of reaction to that idea, and even within the Native American community, I think there is some controversy about that. But he's dealing with us who are outside of that community who value things in a different way.
Yeah.
So, and I mean, if you go to church, they pass the collection plate.
Yes, they do. One of the first experiences that you had with Joseph was your first sweat lodge. And you describe that so vividly in the book. Maybe you can kind of take us there a bit.
And then also let me add that I had a background in talking therapy, in going to psychotherapists for myself and for marriage counseling. And so I had explored that, the whole psychological analysis process. And I found it very valuable in terms of identifying my issues. So I think at the point when I went to my first sweat lodge, I was pretty clear about what my issues were. I knew I was severely codependent and didn't know what to do about it. I was feeling frustrated with psychotherapy in that, okay, I understand what's wrong here, but how do I change it? And that's why the sweat lodge was so powerful for me. And still is. I continue to do the sweat lodge whenever I have the opportunity. Because once I did it, I was like, this is just so practical. This makes so much sense. So in the sweat lodge, the sweat lodge is a symbolic womb. You're returning to the womb, and it's the womb of Mother Earth. And then the fire and the rocks that are heated in the fire represent the male energy entering the womb. So you set an intention before you go in the sweat lodge of how you would like to be reborn if you get the opportunity to actually be born again. So you enter the sweat lodge, and here is the ceremony of heat and darkness and steam, and you really can concretize being blown apart. Being disassembled, disassembling your molecules, and then reassembling yourself with intention in the way that you want to be. And it's in four rounds, like the four directions. It usually cools down between those four rounds and heats up again. And in the iconography of the medicine wheel, where there are the four directions, one of the levels of that is mental, physical, emotional, and spiritual, and that we're in balance when those are in balance. So it gives you the opportunity to rebalance that also and then emerge in the new way that you intend for yourself. And the fact that it's so physical, so visceral, as well as on this metaphoric level, to me it just worked.
Well, the way you're describing it now is beautiful. In the book, you describe it very concretely in terms of how hot it was, and you weren't sure you were going to survive.
Well, and it is. It's really hot. It's really dark, and it's really scary. And I think one of the levels that it works on is it puts you face to face with your fear in a very visceral way, and you need to sit there and be with it in almost this Buddhist sense of being with the uncomfortable, the things that scare you, until you're okay with it. You know, it's not like it goes away and you're not afraid. You're still afraid, but you're okay with being afraid.
And emotions come up in that experience too.
Very, very strongly. I think, you know, I cried more tears in the sweat lodge, and it's a safe place to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's a safe arena to allow all of these emotions that we may consider dark or negative to be flow through you and be expressed in that, and then you're giving them away into the rocks. They're being vaporized and returned to the universe to be allowed to go out and work somewhere else.
You've made a couple of references to Jung in this conversation so far, and I know you mentioned before we got on the call here that you had listened to my interview with the Jungian shaman, and you have some ideas about the archetype. So let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, I've worked, besides working with Joseph, I've worked with some other native teachers, although not as deeply as with him. But I have worked also very deeply with a West African Babalao priest, where they have this whole system of the Orishas, which are all archetypes. And in the Native American medicine work, you have the archetypes of the four directions and four elements and animals and rock people and all these sorts of beings. And I find that the indigenous teachers I've worked with are very aware on a sophisticated level that these are archetypes. These are energies that exist outside of us and within us. And as we integrate, say, masculine and feminine, or on more sophisticated levels, warriors and erotic goddesses and the tides of the ocean and all that, and as we integrate those in ourselves, that is our healing process. And so I find it kind of amusing when people call these teachers primitive, because actually they're working very much with the same kind of thing that Jung was working with and are very aware that they're doing that.
That's interesting. You know, another thought that comes to mind is a lot of times when people are thinking about going to see a traditional psychotherapist, they wrestle with the question of how do you find a good therapist? What are the guidelines that would let you know that you're going to be to find somebody who's going to be ethical and who really knows what they're doing? And I would think maybe the same sort of question comes up when one moves towards non-traditional approaches. So let me put that question to you. How can a person tell? You know, I assume that there are people out there that in some ways are snake oil salesmen, if you will, maybe who aren't as ethical or aren't as well-trained, etc. So how would one find a shamanic practitioner who would be trustworthy?
Well, for me, and what I really appreciated about Joseph was that the emphasis is that you are the one that does the healing. The shaman really doesn't do the healing. He can kind of guide you. He can kind of show you techniques, but it's really you doing the work of healing. So for me, an ethical shaman is one that is really training you to trust your own intuition, training you to recognize what you are resonating with and what's going to work for you, because I think it's slightly different for different people, as medical, you know, traditional medical things are also. So that's what I look for, is somebody who's working with me to develop my own instincts, and I'm less trustful of very dogmatic, you know, that there's one right way to do it and we all have to do it the same way. Mm-hmm. Joseph says often, don't get caught in form, that ceremony is supposed to evolve for the current time and the current culture and the people involved. Joseph is very clear that he's not a traditional Native American shaman, that he has adapted the things that he thinks works from that tradition for people of different ethnicities, the current contemporary culture, what the earth needs at this time. And he makes a big point of that, of not saying that he's traditional. And he has caught some flack, I think, from the Native American community for teaching people who are not Native. And he had a vision early on that that was what he was supposed to do, because they were the ones doing the damage. And if they didn't learn these ways, then, you know, the earth was, you know, over. It would, you know, so he had that vision. He follows that vision, but he is clear. He doesn't call himself traditional in that way.
Seems like there's a real groundswell of interest in this to match that vision, that there's a real groundswell among, how do I refer to us, gringos, whites, whatever, of interest in shamanic practices.
Yeah, and more teachers who are willing to teach them, which is a great blessing for us. And I don't want to make any of the Native people who feel it's wrong for others to teach us, to make them wrong either. I think, you know, there's value in both points of view. And we, you know, be in that holding of the tension of opposites between them.
Yes. Now, at a later point in your journey, drumming and dancing became really important transformative tools. You describe a wonderful experience that involved several days of fasting, dancing, and eventually hurling yourself against a tree. Can you take us through that?
Well, Joseph does these medicine dances, these healing marathon dance fasts that are adaptations of Native American traditions like the sun dance, where in groups you go out and you set a clear intention, and the intention, global intention, is always for world peace in his case, and then you can also have personal intentions for healing underneath that. The idea being to go back to the basic metaphysics behind the whole thing, that we are all, everything is simply vibration at more and less density and faster and slower vibration. And this is a very basic traditional belief to Native people. And it is what quantum physics is now confirming with string theory and these basic things, that the atoms are just all vibrating at different rates. So with that background, the idea is that things can be changed through vibration. And so drumming, singing, dancing are all ways of realigning vibrations in a positive and healing way. One of Joseph's books, Joseph has several books. You can go on Amazon and look them up. And one of his is Being in Vibration, one of his older ones, where he goes into this in a very technical way, explaining how it works. He's going to have another book coming out this fall called Sound, Peace, Power. It's going to have a CD included of him chanting some of these traditional, or I guess some of the chants that he was sent by Spirit. So you can actually hear it. So these marathon dances are a way of healing at the very most basic cellular atomic level. So you go out in groups, and for 3 or 4 days on these various dances, no food, no water, constant dancing to the drums. I mean, there's some rest breaks in there, but pretty much for the whole time. So you are put into a deep trance. It's a meditation for the dancer. It's not kind of any kind of performance or you know, anything like that. It's a deep enforced trance for the dancer. So you really get in touch with your deep quiet, with all your issues, which are going to come up in your face because there's nowhere else to go, and with death, because that's enough time of not having water in particular to give you an experience of what it feels like to be getting close to that edge. Mm. And that's very powerful because one of the underlying teachings of Joseph's work, and I think we're seeing this now in more and more of our spiritual and metaphysical teachers, is that really it all comes down to choosing between love and fear. Are we going to live our lives acting from love, or are we going to live our lives acting from fear? And what are we really afraid of? We're afraid of dying. We're afraid of not being loved. And so that's another reason the sweat lodge is so powerful, putting us up against understanding and recognizing our fear. And this also. And so once you get close enough to death, and for me the experience was that it was simple and peaceful and quiet, and like I could have just stepped across. So that huge fear of that then is not so big anymore.
The fear of dying.
The fear of dying. And so, you know, once that isn't such a big thing, all the other little things that happen in your life that you don't control are kind of like, you know, no big deal.
Well, that really leads into a question that I wanted to ask you, which is looking at this sort of whole journey that you've been on. You know, what did you learn on this journey? How has it changed you or the way that you approach life?
Well, I think that love-fear question is the main, the heart of it. I now am really able to recognize when I am acting from fear or making a decision from fear and how to just stop and not do that. And, it's not always easy to act from love and know that you're doing that, but I have a much better sense of that now. Another thing that Joseph taught is the teaching of the hollow bone, so that we are, our ultimate goal is to simply be a hollow bone, and all kinds of emotion travels through that bone. Everything that we feel, our joy, our sadness, our anger, our fear, and to not judge any of those as positive or negative, good or bad, right or wrong, but to allow them to flow through us, so to fully experience whatever we're feeling, but then let it go through so that other energies can also run through us, and know that we're the bone, we're always there in wholeness. Which is actually a very Buddhist kind of idea.
Yeah, I was just thinking that because the interview before this is with someone on the topic of mindfulness meditation, which is just stated in a different way, the idea of, you know, watching the thoughts and the emotions, you know, run through us without getting hooked by them.
And so I think he would say, okay, you're feeling depressed. Well, why are you depressed? Is it appropriate for what's going on in your life? And then enter it. Like, go into that depression instead of taking an antidepressant to not feel it. Go into it and feel it really deeply. Let it flow through you as the bone. And then it can go. But the more that you take the antidepressants and you say, oh, I shouldn't be depressed, and I need to get over this and push it down, the more it's going to come back bigger.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think I have that tool. I mean, a lot of this for me was tools to work with the issues that I knew I already had.
Yes. Well, you know, in the book you described that one major dance. I know there were many different times that you danced, but there was this one that you focus on in the book that ends up with you hurling yourself against that tree. Kind of as you made reference to the sun dance, where there's really a physical trial, and I think in some settings they actually put hooks in their skin and
they pierce under the pectoral muscle with a bone.
Yes.
And then they pull against the tree, and that I believe is the Lakota tradition, and I am not an expert on the Lakota tradition and I can't speak for them at all, but Joseph is half Southern Ute and half Picaris Pueblo. And as I understand it, he's adapted the Southern Ute way of doing it, which is this hitting the tree. So So in the course of the four-day dance, no food, no water, and you're inside a corral, which is a sort of cauldron or container for the energies, you're dancing back and forth to a tree in the center, like spokes of a wheel. The dancers like spokes of a wheel. So there's a community sense in here. You're working with a community energy. So if the individual dancer feels called by the tree, and this is the part where you're getting in touch with your own intuition. If you feel called by the tree, then they run and they hit the tree. They actually collide with the tree. And that's a reassembling of molecules also. In Castaneda talks about the assemblage point quite a bit. So what this is like an actual reconfiguring of your assemblage point, moving of the assemblage point.
Okay.
The hitting of the tree.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have, since that first dance, which I describe in the book, and the first sun-moon dance, which Joseph calls it because he includes women in it, because he felt the masculine and feminine energies need to be balanced in the dance. So, again, I feel very privileged that I, you know, was able to find a dance that included women. And since then, because he recommends that you do at least a series of four dances. So I have danced since then several times. And I've noticed over the years that the hitting of the tree by the experienced dancers has become more gentle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's perhaps in our evolution, we know that we don't need to hit the tree as hard as we did early on, that we found more gentle ways to evolve and shift. So, that first time was, I really did it at full commitment.
you knocked yourself out, I believe. I was shocked, as maybe you were at the time, when at the end of that ceremony, Joseph more or less announced his retirement. And he charges you and the others who were taking part in that dance to carry on the teaching. What was the impact on you at that time? You must have felt shocked as well.
It was very shocking. That was 1997 that Joseph retired. And we were all, for one thing, we were just coming out of the 4 days. It was at the end of the 4 days of dancing. So we were in a highly altered state. And then he announced his retirement and that, you know, those of us who had been studying with him were now empowered to carry on the work. And we were just so shocked and everyone was really emotional about it. Also at that time, he announced that he had been diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and was going off to heal himself, which he has. I mean, that was 11 years ago and he's fine. He's living as a recluse now. He no longer interacts publicly or teaches publicly, but his health is good. And so, you know, we were emotional, we were upset, and my reaction was, what, me teach? You know, I don't know anything. You know, look at, Joseph has a whole lifetime of training and studying, and, you know, he can't hand this over to me. You know, so, and I think maybe just now, as the book is coming out, that I'm really becoming comfortable with the idea of teaching.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, your book describes what feels like may have been a magical period during your life. Would you say that the magic kept happening at that same level down to the present moment, or was that a special period in your life with an eventual return to what might be called, quote, normalcy?
I think there's no normalcy for me ever again.
Okay.
That was certainly a heightened and exciting time, and but the next book is sort of semi-simultaneous and after that. Well, although that period really isn't over because I still do work with Joseph, although at a greater distance. But I also worked with this West African teacher, so the next book will be about the West African teaching, flaws and all in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I still, you know, this informs my life. I journey when I have a question that I need answered. I go into one of the not an ordinary realities looking for answers. I still dance. I still do sweat lodges. And I still follow those synchronistic coincidences, which continue to occur. So, yeah, well, I think once you start doing it, that's how you live.
Interesting. I had intended to ask you how have you kept the magic alive in your life, and I guess that's what you've just described.
And I think once you kind of get comfortable with being out there in the world of the unknown, and knowing that spirit will step in and lift you up. It's ever present, and so you kind of go out in this world of not knowing. There was a period for 5 years where I sold my house in Los Angeles because I couldn't afford to keep it anymore with the work in the moving business not being there, not knowing what I would do. And as soon as it went into escrow, friends who lived in Mexico called me and said they wanted to go to Italy and would I house it. So I went to Mexico for 6 months and was able to go, met an anthropologist and was able to go up and spend some time with the Huichols. And then it just continued that I did 5 years of basically house sitting and moving around and traveling and not having a home. And one of the things that Joseph says is the true warrior has no home. And I got quite comfortable with that. And then ultimately, through another series of synchronistic coincidences, ended up settling in Santa Fe for now, which I'm really enjoying.
Well, that's great. I'll tell you, all that magic really comes through in the book and in your writing. As a result of our correspondence, I learned about an upcoming conference of shamanic practitioners in New Mexico. And for a time, I thought I might be able to go, but the timing doesn't work for me. And I was surprised. I shouldn't have been, but I was surprised to see that you're both one of the founding members and also that you're going to be conducting a workshop on dance.
Well, I wouldn't say that I'm a founding member. I'm a member, this is their fourth annual conference, and it'll be the first one I've attended.
Oh, okay.
And yes, I am presenting a workshop on medicine dancing, which I do when I'm invited in different locations. And I do sort of a abbreviated mini version of the trance dance. So it's not the no food, no water, because it's only for a short period of time. But people do experience the trance and experience some results from the setting of intention. And, I just kind of give them an experience of what the deep trance is like. And, it's fun. It's interesting.
Okay. Well, other than your own book, which I highly recommend, and you've also mentioned Joseph Real, and I will maybe put a link to Amazon in the show notes somewhere. Is there another book or two that you'd recommend to our listeners?
Well, I like Brooke Medicine Eagle's books. The Last Ghost Dance is her most recent one, and she talks about the trance dance in there. And then her previous one on White Buffalo Woman Comes Singing. And also the Michael Harner book, The Way of the Shaman, where he describes his cross-cultural studies of the drum journey trance. I think that's a really basic shamanic text for everyone.
I think he lives quite close to me. I heard about him when I was off doing the shaman workshops that I went to in Utah with my friend Alberto Violdo, and ran into people there who were referring to Michael Harner. So I should probably think of interviewing him.
And yes, and he has the Foundation for Shamanic Studies, which is up in the Bay Area, where he, I think they're actually trying to do a map of alternate realities cross-culturally.
Interesting.
Quite an interesting project.
Yes, yes. So as we wind down here, what's your advice to those of us who perhaps don't have a Joseph, a beautiful painted arrow in our life?
Follow your intuition, because you will find the right teacher for you. And if you are interested in these marathon dances, they are going on with followers of Joseph, including his brother, Benito Real. And you will find them if you research it, and it really, you know, speaks to you. And, you know, like, you have found your teacher that you're studying with, and I'm sure that that's the right teacher for you. You know, so I think it's like, trust your intuition, go through what doors open for you, follow your own path, and follow your inspiration. If it calls to you, you know, explore it.
Great. Well, Marcia Scarborough, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks, Dr. Dave. It was great talking to you.
And I hope you found this conversation with Marcia Scarborough to be of interest. The title of her book, again, is Medicine Dance, One Woman's Healing Journey into the World of Native American Sweat Lodges, Drumming Meditations, and Dance Fasts. Now, please be aware that I have no financial interest in the books or authors I recommend. That having been said, I can pretty safely guarantee that you'll find this book a good and inspiring read. Once you pick it up, it'll be hard to put down. Marcia has a website at www.marciascarborough.com, and that's spelled MarciaScarborough.com, and you'll find a link in our show notes as well. You can find books by her teacher on Amazon.com, where his name is Joseph Rael, and that's spelled R-A-E-L. You also heard us make brief mention of the sun dances practiced by the Lakota Sioux. A few years back, I had two Native American students. The man was a Lakota Sioux of about my own age, and we became friends, but unfortunately, I didn't make it to any of his sweat lodges. He also invited me to a Sundance ceremony in the Dakotas. I now regret that I didn't go on that trip either. They both earned master's degrees at Sonoma State University, planning to take their new skills back to the reservation lands to help with the problems of alcohol and drug addiction, which have beset so many Aboriginal peoples around the planet as a result of their contact with white civilization. I think you heard me mention the upcoming Society for Shamanic Practitioners meeting in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I thought I might attend as a podcast journalist, and Marcia helped me to set that up, but for a variety of reasons, it won't work out. I was thinking it would be a good way to get my batteries recharged, especially since my Barcelona trip fell through. Note to self, get batteries recharged.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
It's supposed to go up to 101 degrees Fahrenheit here today, which is hot. And even though it's now only 10 in the morning, it's already hot in my little upstairs studio. I want to get this out before it gets any hotter here. By the way, I forgot last time to mention my most recent interview with Dr. Natalie Rogers at www.wisecounselpodcast.com. I think most of my listeners will be particularly interested in that interview. Natalie is the daughter of the famous and very influential psychologist Carl Rogers. She has extended his work into the area of expressive arts therapy. Check it out. I can't believe the way our transcription project has taken off. At this point, we have 10 completed transcripts and promises to complete another 8. You can track the progress of this under the transcripts menu at shrinkwrapradio.com. And again, I want to thank volunteers Jason Howard, Susan Argalin, and Joe Kelly for their work in making this happen, as well as others who've contacted me to take on a transcription. I'll read their names out as their transcripts become available. The latest exciting wrinkle to all this is that listener Axel Reisdorf is a Gestalt therapist and English teacher in Germany, and he's asked some of his German high school students to take on transcription as a way of practicing and improving their English skills. I've already heard from several of them. I'm holding my breath to see if their skills are in fact good enough for me to use their transcripts. I might be able to use a volunteer or two who would be willing to go through their transcripts while listening to the interview to make any needed corrections. I don't have time to do this, but it would not be as labor-intensive for a volunteer as doing the whole transcription. So if you'd like to join our volunteer corps, just drop me a line. Along with the satisfaction of helping out and getting to review some Shrink Wrap Radio content, you get the added perks of hearing your name read out here, having your name posted on our site, and also a link to your personal website or blog if you have one, which in turn will help to boost your Google ranking. You can use the transcripts currently on the site as models for how to format. Do it in Microsoft Word, please, and then I'll do the conversion into an Adobe Acrobat file and put it on the site. So think about volunteering. It's a way to re-enjoy your favorite interview or interviews and really steeping yourself in them again. My friend Jerry and I are going to do another Shrink Wrap Radio live session on Sunday morning, May 25th at 10 a.m. Pacific Time. You can participate live with us by going to www.blogtalkradio.com/shrinkwrapradio, and you'll be able to call us on the phone number that you'll see there, or to join in on the web chat. So I hope you'll be there. If you've listened to the early shows going back to 2005 and 2006, you may recall that Frank Small volunteered to be our correspondent down under, which is to say Australia. Frank submitted 5 interviews before he was overtaken by school and life in general. I just want to give a shout out to Frank now, congratulating him on his recent graduation. Frank now has a BA. Way to go, Frank. Have you heard of Twitter? You can check it out at www.twitter.com. That's T-W-I-T-T-E-R. I've been hearing about Twitter for the past year or so, and I've been somewhat skeptical about getting involved with it, but a couple of listeners have urged me to start Twittering as a way of staying in touch with my audience. Basically, it's like a micro-blog or a form of instant messaging whereby if you sign up to follow me, you'll get brief periodic messages from me called tweets. They can't be any longer than 140 characters. And I guess you can tweet back at me. I still don't fully understand how it works. It's supposed to be really good for mobile phones. So if you do join Twitter, you can, quotes, follow me, that is, subscribe to me at Twitter/shrinkwrapradio. And that's all one word. Shrinkwrap Radio is all one word, lowercase. I'll be posting occasional tweets and show announcements, most likely from my iPhone. So let's try it out together and see if it works and see if we like it or not. The sponsors for this show, of course, are Mevio and GoDaddy. Listen up, because GoDaddy is running a 25% discount for a limited time. From May 15 through June 15, 2008, you can get a 25% discount off any order of $100 or more just by using the code SHRINK25, that's S-H-R-I-N-K, the numeral 2, the numeral 5, at checkout from the GoDaddy site. This is great for those of you who need to purchase bucket loads of domain names or who need hosting, bandwidth, or other services. You can check out all of our GoDaddy discount codes on our site at shrinkwrapradio.com.
Hi, this is Fernando Blanco from Mexico City. You're on the couch, on a rock, on a boat, on a plane, with Dr. Dave.
Okay, that's a signal to catch up on some reader emails. First, we hear from a rabbi/psychologist in Israel who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, some reflections on your interview with Shenzhen Young." My interview with Shenzhen Young, by the way, I think was on Wise Counsel and is not to be missed. The rabbi goes on, "First of all, it was excellent. I'm so grateful to you for bringing such talented people to your show. Keep up the good work." He says, "Call Hakavad and keep up the good work. For the most part, I submit to what Dr. Young had to say. His formulation of mindfulness was brilliant. I'm still learning about meditation, mindfulness, and concentration. Ever since doing some formal training in hypnosis, I've realized the gift that it is to be able to be where I am. My patients, my family, and the world that I encounter since learning how to concentrate have all been much better off. Yet two things troubled me. The first was the discussion about reducing costs of therapy to insurance companies and to society as a whole. Reducing financial costs seems like a worthwhile goal. Yet I believe that if anything, the methods of mindfulness intervention and the fact that they financially cost less should be used to actually make it more available to more people. If anything, we as mental health professionals should be looking to get more help to more people." Well, I certainly agree with you about that, and I think Shenzhen Young would as well. The rabbi goes on to say, "Thoreau was so right when he said most men live lives of quiet desperation. If anything, he was too optimistic, judging from what I facetiously call the booming of the anesthesia industries of Hollywood entertainment, materialism, and pharmaceuticals. More and more people are sinking down into misery. Psychotherapy in general and meditation practices in particular are the only real way to connect people with the joy of life that doesn't simply distract them or numb them." Well said. The second idea was related to that which was not discussed. Why meditate or concentrate or practice mindfulness at all? From a practical point of view, we offer meditation to patients much like any intervention. Meditation, like the self-talk methods of cognitive therapy, or the free association methods of psychodynamic-oriented therapy, or the artistic and imaginal methods of Jungian therapies, offer alleviation of suffering. That in and of itself is usually a worthy goal. Yet my experience is that we need more direction than that. Sometimes it's wrong to alleviate suffering because the individual's suffering is due to his or her failure to connect with life in a positive way. Once a person makes the necessary changes, the suffering goes away. In a sense, I think of meditation as a magnetic compass that is inside a lead-lined wall. The pointer may spin free, but there is no magnetic attraction to connect with. This is where values, and for me, Yiddishkeit comes in. These are just two items that I want to bring to your attention. Thank you again for making this information available to the public. Keep up the good work. And it's signed Rabbi Dr. Josh Mark, PhD, Jerusalem, Israel. And he also gave his website, which I'll be happy to share with you, particularly if you're in Israel and you're looking for counseling therapy services. You'll find his website at www.counselingexcellence.com. And I was sufficiently impressed by Dr. Josh Mark's note that I thought he might make a good guest for Shrink Wrap Radio. So I sent off an email to him suggesting that, and he responded in the following terms. "Hi, Dr. Dave. I'd be flattered and honored to be interviewed. You tell me the whens and hows, and you got me. So don't let me forget about this, Josh. I have got kind of a long list here of guests, and I don't want to lose you in the process. So I hope to get you on here before too much longer. He goes on to say, by the way, and you probably know this already, but Israel has some homegrown talent here as well. Professor Yisrael Orbach at Bar Ilan is an international expert on suicide, which is a national epidemic here, especially among the young. He's also as close to a tzaddik as I've ever encountered. Professor Yoram Bilou at Hebrew University is an anthropologist and psychologist whose expertise is shamanism and exorcism. He goes all over the planet observing exorcisms. And that was news to me. I didn't know that exorcisms fit into the world of Judaism. And so I had a little exchange with Josh about that, and he assured me that, yes, it does for some parts of Judaism. Not all Jews would subscribe to that, but some do. He goes on to say that Ilan Kutz is a psychiatrist, artist, traumatologist, and one of the flight surgeons on the rescue at Entebbe in 1976, and that he tells great stories. He says, you may know that Edna Foa at the University of Pennsylvania and the goddess of cognitive behavioral therapy and anxiety is Israeli as well. No, I didn't know that. You know, I was an undergraduate at the University of Pennsylvania, and I did not major in psychology at the time, although I did take a few psych classes there. Boy, it has emerged as one of the major heavy hitters in psychology. So I should be proud to be a graduate of Penn. He goes on, he finishes up his letter saying, I look forward to hearing from you. And he says, oh, I discovered Shrink Wrap about a year ago on iTunes. Love at first listen, Josh Mark. So, Josh, I do look forward to talking to you before too much longer. Then we hear from another therapist, this time in the UK, who writes, Dear All at Shrink Wrap. Well, I got a kick out of that because there is no all. I am all there is at Shrink Wrap. But he says, Dear All at Shrink Wrap, my name is Philip Hodgson. And I'm a psychotherapist working in the UK in the National Health Service in private practice and as a lecturer. I just wanted to say that I thoroughly enjoy your radio show and also find it immensely valuable. The Sarah Hannah Radcliffe interviews on Wise Counsel have been first class. Her communication skills are excellent, and I thank you for getting such a vibrant guest. I'm now telling all my students to tune in. Yay! Good luck and best wishes in your future interviews and ventures. And sorry to hear about Barcelona, Phil. And yeah, I was sorry to have to cancel out of that myself. And so again, I think he wouldn't mind my giving his full name here. It's Philip A.J. Hodgson. And his private practice group has a website. So if you're in the UK, and particularly if you're interested in the transpersonal, that is a spiritual approach to your problems, one that combines spirituality and psychology, check out their website at www.transpersonalemergence.com. And then I hear from longtime listener Mike, who says, it's Mike in Chicago again. I just wanted to let you know that I thoroughly enjoyed the interviews with Jill Taylor and Shenzhen Young. Thank you. As you mentioned, it would be great if you could host a discussion with these two guests. Please don't hesitate to book guests that study similar subjects. I still love your podcasts. They are such a wonderful exploration of the human condition. I've learned so much, and several of the podcasts have had profound effects on me. Your dedicated fan, Mike. Well, Mike, I keep chasing after Jill Taylor to see if she'd be up for doing a combined interview with Shenzhen Young, and she is just so busy right now. What did she? I wrote to her recently, and she got back to me. And what is it? Oh, it's that her book has been picked up by a major publisher, and so now she's on a book tour for the next several months. So I don't know if it's going to happen or not. And then finally, let me wrap up with a letter from Derek, a longtime listener up in Canada, who writes, Hi, Dr. Dave. I've written several times and suggested your interviews with Dr. Edward Tick and with Dr. Robert Altemeyer. And both of those recommendations led to interviews. I think two of the that are right up there among the very best interviews that we've had here. He goes on to say, well, I have another one for you. Again, it's prompted by a talk I heard on another podcast. The potential interview is Ariel Garten. And the talk I heard her give was on the neuroscience of conflict. And more interestingly, in my opinion, the neuroscience of altruism and cooperation, originally delivered in Toronto for the Salon Voltaire series of speakers and broadcast on TV in Ontario and then podcast in audio form on the Canadian Voices podcast. And so I was able to find that on iTunes, and she would make a good guest. And so I hope to follow up on that. And he points out in a subsequent email, in case anybody else wants to look for this interview on Canadian Voices, which is in iTunes, you'll find it. It's episode number 13 of season 3, and it's the second half of the podcast. The first half is given by somebody else, a Manel Matani. Interesting in its own right, but Ariel Garten's, which would be more germane for my audience, is in the second half of that recording. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails, as always, to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And you know how much I like voice messages, which you can leave me on Skype or using my Chingo or the phone that we have at 206-337-0622. So let me hear from you. Thanks again to Marcia Scarborough for sharing her fascinating journey in the world of shamanism with us. I'm really looking forward to next week's interview with author Sue Halpern, who has a wonderful new book covering the front lines of memory research. And I just discovered as I sat down to read the newest issue of the New Yorker magazine that she's written the lead story in this week's New Yorker. So until next week, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.